Todos estamos cansados.
Pero we don't want to have time delays. We are all tired, but we still have to see very high-level works, very interesting presentations. So let's start, and I believe other colleagues are going to join us in the next minutes. This is a plenary session, a very interesting session. What we learned about H1N1 pandemic flu, this is going to be moderated by Dr. Vicente Madrid from this institute. Thanks, Nelly. First of all, I would like to thank you for the invitation to moderate this very important session from the global perspective, global health perspective. It is a topic that has been for a year in our minds and in our mouths. In order to have this meeting and to have this session, we're going to have Dr. Jarbas Barbosa. He represents the Pan-American Health Organization, and Dr. Hugo Lopez, Director of Epidemiology from the Ministry of Health, and Dr. Cole D. McDonald, who is the Chairman for Global Health Initiatives. First, we're going to have Dr. Jarbas Barbosa from Dr. Barbosa is a Brazilian physician from the Federal University of Pernambuco, epidemiologist from the Osvaldo Cruz Foundation, Fiocruz, a director for Campiñas State University in São Paulo. He has worked as coordinator of the HIV/AIDS program in Pernambuco, Ministry of Health, at the Olinda Municipality, Ministry of Health of Pernambuco, director of the National Center of Epidemiology, Public Health Epidemiology, Surveillance, and Executive Secretary for the Ministry of Health. In the year 2007, he was appointed Manager for Sanitary Surveillance and PAHO disease person. Good morning, and thank you very much. On behalf of the American Health Organization, I would like to thank for the invitation to be with you and to share with you some of the lessons learned and some of the pending lessons. I believe those lessons were very hard and difficult to understand. And here we're going to see the assessment, the internal assessment we did at the World, at the Pan-American Health Organization in the regional office. We coordinated the response to the pandemic in the region, and we also took care of the high-level meetings we held in Cancun. We were invited by the Ministry of Health in Mexico, and there was another meeting held in Miami with technical people from the different countries of the region. The content that I will address, I will make a short summary of the situation of this pandemic, what happened in the Americas, some of the lessons learned, and some key points for detection and response, surveillance, international sanitary code, risk communications measures, and we finish with some of the other lessons we still have pending. I will not tell you the history of pandemic because I believe we all know this history. We should only see how. I believe we were very fortunate to first have this pandemic with the new international sanitary rule as of June 2007. So it has been implemented across the world. After the first detection of something different was happening, what could be different in this breakout in Veracruz and in Mexico, all the way from we saw the different cases, and 2 weeks elapsed. And I believe this was something that with all the review process we are about to start, it is always important to see the international rule, because now with this rule we are more sensitive to detect situations that could become in sanitary emergencies, international ones. Secondly, to guarantee transparency of communications, and it was also an important channel for all countries to be able to share information. And at the initial moment of the pandemic, they were all very important. We were before a disease, we were not sure about the severity, the impact on the society, on health services. And right in the middle of that uncertainty, I believe fast communications and sharing information with the rest of the countries was key to give a more adequate response. In the Americas, we have pretty different situations. I will not give you the epidemiological details because it is not the objective of this presentation, but something that was a big difference in terms of its impact were the areas in the region where there is a very well-defined winter. In the north, we have the curves for the United States, for Canada, and below we have the ones of Mexico and the U.S. and in Canada. There were 2 peaks a year ago, the first one in April and May, which is not a flu-type viral transmission. It is springtime. And then we had a second peak in returning back to classes in September and October, which is not the season for this flu virus transmission. And in Mexico, there were 3 peaks. In Mexico, there were 3 peaks, the first one, and I believe there is evidence that the transmission started a little bit before that, and this calls our attention to all of us, because even in Mexico, which is a country, one of the Latin American countries, with the most developed surveillance system, with the most well-implemented surveillance system, there were difficulties, natural difficulties to perceive what was happening at the beginning. With the exception of the U.S. and Canada, no other Latin American and Caribbean country could quickly detect what was happening, because it was a disease, and in most of the cases it was a transmission very similar to flu. We needed to have an extremely decentralized surveillance system and a great lab capacity in order to quickly identify a new type of virus. Those were the required conditions at the moment of the beginning of the pandemic, and it would be difficult for Latin American countries to reach this, even those who have most developed lab capacities and surveillance capacity. In Central America and in the Caribbean, the situation was different. We had breakouts in services. There we have Costa Rica to the left. Then we have a cluster of several Caribbean countries. In another chart, there were some impacts, there were some outbreaks, but without impacts like the ones we saw in the north and in the south cone. In those countries, we started to see some of the first cases, the uncertainty produced, and the psychological and social impact on people and on health systems. In South America, we had a different behavior. In the tropical zone, outbreaks, higher intensity, but something very different happened in the south countries, Chile, Argentina, with winter times. There we have the curve 4 or 5 times more visits to the physician, 3 or 4 times more hospitalizations because of severe respiratory diseases compared to the worst winters in recent years. In Peru and in the tropical zone, there was an increase in the number of cases, but with a lower magnitude compared to the south cone. Here we have some characteristics of the pandemic. There are some uncertainties that we need to know even better. First of all, we do not know what is the percentage of asymptomatic patients if we take into consideration what happens to the seasonal flu. 30, 40, up to 50%. The hit rate, there are some very consistent estimates that talk about from 10 to 15% of the population. The United States, with 2 waves at the CDC, there was an estimate based on some studies that identified that 25% of the people can have the virus. The rates were very different from among the different countries. You can see the severity of transmission in the different countries. You can see the different protocols that were used in the different countries. But in almost every country, in the severe cases, hospitalizations, 20% needed to go to intensive care units. And in some countries, it was an overburden because these patients needed to have ventilators, and those people needed these ventilators 2 or 3 weeks. And there were some problems, specifically in those countries with more people affected, like the people in the south cone. And mortality rate is also very different. This is not yet the mortality rate. With a close mortality rate data banks, we will have the capacity to properly estimate the actual impact of this pandemic. And I believe these are extremely positive numbers, because this is the number of cases of death that were perceived by the health system. But there are some places where we see the mortality of pregnant women, for example, and there is an increase. There is a small increase in maternal mortality, and there is also a clear increase in the case of young people with severe respiratory diseases. There is a very wide difference in the many different countries, and we need to explore even more what happened, because the virus didn't change. The response has to do with the medical care and the one organized by the country. There are some very important differences in the mortality rates. Despite of the different organization, we have Brazil. Brazil is a very large country, so the average in Brazil is going to give us a very evident percentage for Brazil and for the South Cone. Chile, in the case of Chile, 0.8 for every 6,000 inhabitants. This was a mortality rate. Argentina, 1.44. What if we include the number of cases of death, where it was not possible to have samples to make lab examinations, and which are still today under the review of an specialist committee, because it was such a quick impact and the transmission was so fast that lots of people died without having access to the samples. But since the commission is reaching almost 90% moment of the confirmation. If we are talking about 90% mortality in Argentina, was around 2 cases of death for every 100 inhabitants. In Uruguay, we see the total number of confirmed cases of death, 0.3%, but with a study launched by the Uruguayan report of internal medicine physicians, if you see the mortality, it was 4.3, and if we see other detailed pieces of information, what happened to pregnant women, it was very different. In Chile, with almost 17 million people, only one pregnant woman died. In Canada, the mortality was minor, very, very low in pregnant women, and in other countries, mortality rate among pregnant women was very important. I will be talking about some Brazilian differences. If you see the states in the southern part of Brazil, mortality rate was more similar to the one of Uruguay and Argentina compared to the one we saw in Chile. And this is basically when we reach, if we see other places, we're going to see very different rates. I believe when we talk about the flu, it would be like talking about one same disease, but there are important differences. Seasonal flu, this is a very rare event. It is not common to have cases of death because of the seasonal flu. There are some people, there are some elderly people with a serious disease or severe disease. And flu can cause an imbalance, and then it leads to pneumonia. And 75% of cases of death because of seasonal flu, this is Mexican information, happens only to those who are over 85 years and children under 2 years of age. Now, with the red figures, 70% of cases of death happen to young adults. In other words, there is a change in the performance. And if we see this chart, it is one of the only one system that I know in this region that will monitor the number of deaths. Pediatric cases, it was all started in the year 2006, hospital cases of death, well-documented cases of death in green, deaths in the United States as of the year 2006. And there we also have cases of death produced by the new virus N1H1, and you can clearly see the difference of the behavior and performance in this age group. Here, we will be talking about other important characteristics. We have the mean of cases there we have for countries, but it happens in almost every country. We have like a stair. In most of the cases happen to children and teenagers, and most of the severe cases, here the median is a little bit different. And the number of cases of death, the age median is a little bit higher. This is related to how flu diseases are transmitted. It is very common among schoolmates, and this is why it is very important to vaccinate them to reduce the transmission velocity and to indirectly protect the community, not only school kids, 33-34%, and in the community was around 12-14%. But on the other hand, comorbidity
estão vinculadas aos casos graves são muito mais frequentes
related to severe cases, it is more present among young people and young adults. We didn't see gender differences. In most of the countries, there are some differences in countries with only a few cases because pregnant women were the difference. But even more because of the difference in the response, because of the different capacity to do timely diagnosis and treatment, this is one of the characteristics of the virus. There are not many social studies in our region. We have a report from New York, and it suggests that among Afro-American people, there was a higher ratio, a higher rate of severe cases, maybe because of some risk factors, obesity, which is more prevalent in Afro-American people, and it also could be related to more difficulties to have treatment and diagnosis. In New Zealand and in Australia, there is consistent information, and we can see the incidence of severe cases up to 5 times higher amongst native people. There are some studies in the region that could clear up this component in our region. Most of the symptoms are mild and moderate. This is after the first weeks. This is something that we detected. But if we see the number of people, we have severe pneumonia, progressive pneumonia. It was shown in animals as well as with the first results of the necropsies that were published, different from the flu virus, from the seasonal flu virus, because only the top airways, upper airways. This new virus was across the whole airway system, and there were some progressive cases of pneumonia. Yeah. Or in the cases of progressive pneumonia. Another important piece of information is the early treatment is going to make a big difference. Information from Mexico and from Argentina and from other countries tells us that the faster the diagnosis, the faster the application or the administration of the antiviral, the higher the possibility to survive. And it was also important because there were some comorbidity factors that explained more than 50% of the severe cases. Among them, we have pregnant women, morbid obesity, chronic respiratory diseases, asthma, bronchitis, immunodepressed patients, and there is a long list that was pretty common and published in the different countries. Another characteristic is the following: during the peak of this transmission, that in general terms went from 10 to 12 weeks, the new virus is practically replaced by other flu virus and respiratory virus, with the exception of children. This is Argentina, but we saw the same in Chile, in the southern part of Brazil, and we saw the same in Uruguay. In children, there is an important participation of respiratory syncytial virus, but in other adults, up to 98% of the viral cases were because of the new virus. During the peak, all teenagers and adults were treated. The ones with respiratory symptoms like flu, it was producing a big benefit. This type of attitude, and I believe one of the explanations of the low mortality rate that we saw in Chile. I believe it is necessary to carry out much more studies to balance what actually happened, what did not happen. It is going to be difficult to repeat the conditions across the world. And if we take into consideration all the different pandemic we've seen in the world, we are going to see that this was very different. Its severity was different from other cases of flu. But it is not possible to say that it is only one cat that was dressed or disguised as a lion. I believe it is necessary to make a very important assessment. Department. I respect an American epidemiologist who was very important for the world for the eradication of this smallpox, for example. And once we were talking about this, why are you worried? Because it has the same mortality rate as the pandemic of 1957. And then I thought, would the public opinion would accept 50 years later that we should not worry because the mortality rate is the same as the one we had in 1957. This is a paradox. We epidemiologists look at the past and we always talk about the reduction in the number of cases. But the society is going to ask, how come with all the means you have available today, you are facing the same conditions we were facing many years ago? So it is very important to make this assessment very quickly about the international response that comes all the way from the 14th century when we were given the first listing of diseases in 1851 when the international conferences were started and when the first codes and international rules were created. It was completed in 1869 with international sanitary rule that was reviewed in 1975, and after SARS in the year 2003 we accelerated the revision process, and now we have a new version which is international rule 2005. This new rule, I believe, is possible because of the panic produced by SARS, because it gave place to a very important change in the paradigm that we see in this rule. And if we were not afraid about SARS, it would be very difficult to have the approval of this new international rule, because there are very sensitive country issues. There are important changes. First of all, it is a paradigm change with what happens outside of the borders. Despite of the fact that there are some other actions at the airports and the different ports, this will always be necessary, but the capacity to stop most of the diseases we see today is a minor capacity. The borderline is at the emergency room, not at the airports. And there are some airports that established and implemented thermal scanners. There were countries that took very stringent measures. They were checking the temperature of all the different passengers. If flights were set in quarantine, those people who were suffering from symptoms in those countries, it was not possible to stop everything. Secondly, there is a list of 13 diseases relative to public health threats to have a more proactive surveillance. We would like to have a Google for medicine. It is an attempt by Canada, and they are always looking all day long. They look for news. They do the verification process, and this has increased the sensitivity a lot. In this chart, we have all the different events that were notified to the Pan American Health Organization all the way from the beginning of this international new rule in June 2007. Here we have good and bad news, by the way. These three columns represent the communications of those events that came from the National Liaison Centers. This was the official communications channel. The good news is that at the beginning we had only 10%, but now we have a little bit more than 30%. But at the same time, now almost two-thirds of all the events that gave place to verification processes were not officially communicated by the countries, and those were detected by this Google epidemic that is in charge of this searching process. And I believe this is something we need to look at to determine how we are going to face it, because no country likes to communicate something that the country is not sure about it. It is a trend. First, we do the verification process, and then we make a report whenever there is a better assessment of the risks. Now, in order to conclude, talking about surveillance, it is important to strengthen the detection and risk assessment, and we need to have flexibility. And, for example, it makes sense to determine the total number of cases of flu if there is no community transmission, and after there is community transmission, systems should work with other indicators, for example, the number of beds in intensive care, hospitalizations to determine what was happening in order to coordinate the response in the different countries. Having a preparation plan was very important, but those countries who did not implement what the plan indicated faced many problems. There was a provision to buy personal equipment, protection equipment, and if they didn't buy those equipment, they were facing difficulties when the crisis started. The multi sectorial coordination and participation. There were countries where the president of the countries were the spokesperson, the minister of health. This minister of health was the spokesperson, and it was very important and to then adapt this response strategy. Most of the countries faced contention strategies, but it was very clear that it was not possible to continue working like that. It was difficult to make a contention strategic shift for a mitigation strategy. The participation of health services, the preparation for the peaks, and in some countries like Argentina and Chile, they had to quickly buy respirators because some services capacity was exceeded norms and guides. In other words, physicians who were there, and they were saying, I do not agree with that norm, and that information is not consistent with my information. This should all be based not only on the authority, it also depends on the technical leadership, electronic magazines, and we need to have the context to discuss. We need to have the specialist experts' participation. This was also something very important, and taking care with professionals. In some countries, we reach almost 20%. A failure. We didn't have, and we had a lot of ill professionals. On this topic, there was a lack of evidence. What does work? What doesn't work? And the population has difficulties to work under this uncertainty. We needed to make an analysis of the advantages, disadvantages. Things that were easy in one country were not that easy in other countries. Feasibility studies. In some cases, classes were suspended, but in other countries, we determined there was going to give rise to more problems. And I believe Mexico was a very good example. Mexico had to take very hard measures, stringent measures. And I believe we were all responsible for the lives of others. And it would be very important to take Mexican measures. And there was also a very important social support. One last point that I would like to mention is the risk communications topic. I believe we need to determine if I am the government. Are we all going to be talking about the same information? Because we also have the participation of the media. If there are journalists who say the government people will always try to hide the reality, and I believe the different parties are right. To be honest with you, I believe the media are there, and they want to sell their journals, and they are different types of news, but if there is a sound, reliable source of information, we can overcome this in 1 or 2 days. The problem is that many times sometimes the message is not coherent with what with the reality people say. If a minister says there are no cases, but if we go to the airport and if a day later we start to see more cases in the country, people will not trust. And if this situation would be even applicable to journalists, so if we think in terms of the communications strategy, we need to know that today people have access to information and they look for information because they want to protect themselves and they want to improve this dialogue. International rules, for example, big challenges, basic capacities in the different countries, in each one of the different countries. This new concept of global sanitary security is going to be possible as long as the countries have response and direction capacity, because there are some countries that will not be able to do an adequate treatment for many diseases. In other words, security of everyone, we're going to reach it if we all have the capacity to meet the basic guidelines, international guidelines, recommendations. These are only recommendations. Several countries, even where the World Health Organization, it says that it is not necessary to cancel flights. And if flights are cancelled, this was to have the sensation of being at ease because there was no advantage. Some people believe that in China, despite of the negative impact, they only postponed the introduction of the virus 2 weeks. This was the only one impact, and we need to take all this into consideration. What shall we do in the case of extreme measures? The International Sanitary Code clearly says that countries should be adopting measures based on evidence, but there is no punishment, there are no sanctions. So I believe this is a topic to be subject to discussion. The rule is under revision. The General Director of the World Health Organization invited all the different countries, and I believe the members of that Congress working on global health, I believe, could play a very important role to know how, without affecting the sovereignty of the countries, how are we going to have a favorable environment for transparency where there are no punishments applicable to the country, because, for example, if we do not want to communicate, this is when we're going to face many other problems. Thank you very much.
Now,
I was expecting this pandemic, and yes, so there were some anti-pandemic measures. We made a drill in the year 2005 to simulate a pandemic. The problem is that we were not sure about the type of virus, H1N1. We were expecting the H5N1, which is even more lethal. Fortunately, this is not as lethal as you saw in the information, but what about the transmission rate? It is pretty fast. Now, to share with us Mexican information, we have Hugo López from the Epidemiology Department. He coordinates the National Epidemiological Surveillance System, and it is operated by the National Center of Disease Control and Epidemiological Surveillance, and it has a unique system for epidemiological surveillance and the Intelligence Unit for Health Emergencies, and this is to monitor and to provide this information on the 100 diseases that have great or a terrible risk potential. Dr. Hugo López, you have the floor. Thanks and good morning, almost good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation to participate in this very interesting forum. And in the next minutes, I will share with you some of the lessons that we learned. It is not possible to easily summarize all of them, but some of the ones which are the most relevant ones. And you are going to see the consistency with what Dr. Gervas Barbosa said. In this talk, I will focus on the following. I will be talking about the specific background information, some of the information that is less known on how Mexico detected the first symptoms, the first signals of this flu pandemic. Then I will be talking about the characteristics of the pandemic, and it is one of the lessons learned, the characterization of the pandemic in Mexico, and then I will be talking about five specific lessons that have to do with the preparation response and the comparison between these two, epidemiological surveillance, some of the externalities that this pandemic represented for Mexico, access to vaccination and risk communications. One of the early signals we were given in Mexico about this abnormal epidemiological phenomenon with the respiratory acute diseases was a simple monitoring of acute, non-specified respiratory diseases. And in the epidemiological week number 17, at the end of the month of February, we started to see this excess in the number of notification of acute respiratory, non-specific, generic diseases. What called our attention is the following. There were other signals that were consistent to some epidemic outbreaks, other outbreaks. And after the third week of the month of February, we started to see some minor type flu disease characteristics, and it was not a characteristic of this year. And the outbreaks posed different levels of severity, magnitude levels, and the number of cases that happened. And I would like to highlight this. This was found across the country. Here we have Mexicali, only 3 cases, 2 cases of death, very high lethality, but a very minor outbreak. And there were some other cases in the southern region. There were other very severe cases like this, more severe outbreak like the one we see in Veracruz and in Mexico City. The third element that called our attention was the morphology of the epidemic curve of the flu. Traditionally speaking, flu in almost every country will have a peak that you can see right in the middle of winter. It starts in October and ends at the beginning of April. And in this case, and if we compare the two previous years, we see that the type of flu disease was descending, and then there was a peak, and it was a different signal compared to the conventional signal. The fourth signal was the distribution, a typical age distribution. We had a flu that, if you see only the characteristics, as you know, it will affect the extreme age groups. And in this case, we were seeing this shape, intermediate age groups. Then we had this outbreak of 616 cases in a rural or semi-rural community in the state of Veracruz, Gloria, and it became a very famous place, and there were many speculations on the point of origin or the case zero of pandemic, as the media titles it. It was not, but it was an additional signal, one more signal. But what called our attention is the number of cases, and more than 28% in this region of Veracruz. And as I've said, and a typical age distribution. In the case of Veracruz, there were no people dying, there were no hospitalizations. So we have had this atypical performance. And on March the 13th, Mexico gave this alert on this increase in the incidence of respiratory diseases, specifically a flu, 1 month before the knowledge of a new type of virus. But there was a point of inflection, and here the epidemiological national Mexican system was not prepared for the information compilation, and it was severe pneumonia. Severe pneumonia will not be necessarily be a disease that you need to mandatorily notify, with the exception of some specific outbreaks. And we were given information by the different clinical groups. We were given this informal information from different informal networks of the officials that we have. And this allowed us to have the fifth signal, and this is when we determined that we were facing a radically different phenomenon. So we had this case, this lady, 39 years old. She died after 24 hours of her pneumonia was diagnosed, and we thought it was a SARS case. The Pan American and the World Health Organizations made a specific consultation on this case, and it was, this is the sequence of our second communications according to the international code. The first notification was the Veracruz case, and on April the 17th, we emitted the second epidemiological alert, where we formally gave the alert the country about the existence of this concerning epidemiological phenomena, a type of flu type of disease, a seasonal atypical performance disease. And 24 hours later, the United States communicated to the World Health Organization the existence for the first time of a new type of virus, which is this virus, the one that we know as the California 004-2009 porcine hybrid strain and human strain, which was the cause of this flu that we currently face. To respond, we made an intensive and active surveillance on April the 18th and the 19th in Mexico City, documented the lethality of this type of acute severe respiratory diseases in hospitals of Mexico City, and we found this very high lethality, 4.2 for every 100 cases, and we thought it was a major concern. So in order to follow up the U.S. finding, we sent samples to the National Microbiology Labs in Canada and the flu section of the CDCs in Atlanta, and 24 and 48 hours later, we were told that 26 out of 52 samples were positive for this type of new virus that was detected in California 1 week before that. That night, the Ministry of Health announced the measure, the extreme and intense measure, to close the Mexico City schools and the ones in the state of Mexico in order to do some of the first contention maneuvers when we were still thinking in terms of contention in the central part of the country. The rest is history, and I will now share the epidemiological characteristics that we've seen after a year of this epidemic. As I already said, we saw an excessive number of hospitalizations. In this curve, we see the number of hospitalizations because of pneumonia, and we're using this zigzag is what we're expecting to see on a yearly basis. This is the result of the average of the last 3 years, and you can see how this have this excessive number of hospitalizations, and in the different regions of the country, we were observing this, and it ratifies our impression that it was not a phenomenon only in the central part of Mexico, but it was also present across the national territory. And as Dr. Barbosa said, there was an atypical distribution of this age curve And this is something we publish at a specific point in time in this article, and we observe that for those people from 5 up to 59 years of age, there was a multiplication, and in some of the cases even more than 10 times, compared to the proportional distribution of severe pneumonias notified to the Mexican epidemiological system. Another important learning is the basic number of reproduction. As you know, this is a number that sets the parameter of the transmission of a communicable disease, and it is translated as the number of secondary cases that would emerge whenever there is one case that is theoretically susceptible, whenever we have a new virus, when there is an initial disease case, where the information of the Mexican epidemiological surveillance system, it was possible to calculate 1.6%. This was this basic reproduction number or rate, and we determined that it corresponded to the shape or to the transmission or communication or transmission rate of the pandemic of 1957 and 68, and it was not that related to the pandemic of 1918. Another interesting phenomenon is the geographical heterogeneity. Flu is not a disease that is it spreads as minor outbreaks with variable magnitudes and severe. They are different in terms of their severity, depends on the population, and it follows the transportation route, and it is difficult to reveal the direct propagation route. What we saw in Mexico, and it is an explanation of this intermediate peak that we saw in the summer, unlike Canada and the United States with only the April and October peak. But in the southern region, which is represented in red, we had an excessive number of flu type of diseases. It was a notification bias because of the more intense surveillance, specifically in Chiapas and in Quintana Roo and Yucatan. But we also observed this pendulum phenomenon in our territory. Flu was going from the center to the south, from the south to the center, and then to the north. And as I've said, there are no consecutive waves of transmission. Rather, these three transmission places, central, south, north, central, and north. But in reality, we are talking about a type of a small spot propagation. In terms of the virus, what we've seen in Mexico is what we've seen in other countries. The pandemic H1N1 pandemic flu virus took control over other cases, symptomatic cases, type of flu diseases. In green, you can see that practically as of the week 36, 37, it has 95% of all the isolated respiratory virus, and this is something we still see nowadays. Another important concern has to do with the origin of the pandemic. Is it Mexico? Is it Canada? Was it the United States? In technical terms and public health interventions, makes no sense. But there was a point in time when it was politically important, and there were important consequences, as I will be saying, in the externalities. We only look for the response to this question, and we were analyzing all the viral samples that were isolated at the Epidemiological Reference and Diagnostics Center, and we went all the way to January the 1st. We stopped there because there were no more positive samples. The oldest sample that is the one you see here is one case, 1 6-month-old girl who lived in San Luis Potosí, and it also dissipated the mythology of the three of the porcine tails that were located in La Gloria, because remember that we thought that at the beginning the point of interest was located in Veracruz. It is a generally mild disease, This is what we see in most of the cases, and virulence has been stable along the epidemic one-year period. In Mexico, we have up to 0.2% cases of death and 10% of hospitalizations. And there are some other subpopulations which are at a very high risk. A summary of this overview, when we estimated the likelihood of hospitalization and cases of death, we saw that the age difference with an arbitrary cutoff in more than 35 years of age increases the risk, and comorbidity, diabetes, chronic pulmonary disease, and infections, chronic HIV infections or AIDS, those are very important risk determinants. Another phenomenon that contributed the most to the risk of complications and death was the therapeutic timeliness. In this chart that was given by the colleagues from the Mexican Institute of Social Security, we see the sequence in time and the number of average days after a hospitalization, how many days it took the person to go and look for assistance. You can see that at the beginning there were 14 days. This was average time of delay to go to the hospital, up to 34 days in some of the cases. Fortunately, and as an effect of these official communications and the media communications about the concern, there was a decrease and it has been relatively stable, and it is now 1.7 days. But the cases of complications and cases of death that we still see, in average more than 6 days of delay to go and look for medical assistance, despite of the fact that they can go to a hospital, they will not always be given a treatment. Another concern, as Dr. Barbosa said, is pregnant women. In our country, we have an immediate notification system to notify cases of death of mothers. Concurrent with the pandemic, which is represented here by the red curve and the blue and the green, we can see an increase of up to 5 times the highest peak of the pandemic, 5 times the proportion of maternal cases of death compared to previous years. And when we did so by cause, and when we were grouping the direct obstetric causes, which are normally the main contributors to this maternal mortality, and when comparing it to respiratory causes, if you compare the previous 2 years where the 3% was not exceeded, as pneumonia is a specific cause of death among pregnant women, we had 16% when closing our information report in the year 2009, an increase of more than 5 times, a very important concern. And this is why the ratio of maternal mortality because of a specific reason up to 1.9 cases of death, and it was the third cause of death in pregnant women, higher than traditional causes of death like septicemia and abortion. There was another point in time about their perception. On the one hand, young people, they didn't believe that this type of cold disease could cause something very serious, severe hospitalization and death. But it was a group with the more likelihood to suffer from this disease. But adults, the adult population, they were the ones with more risk to have complications. So who is the person we need to give a service to? Is it my brother or my grandfather? This dual message caused an important confusion, and we believe it was the incorrect perception, and it contributed to the paralyzation of the social response with respect to the service. As you can see in these two overlapping curves, in blue, the possibility to go to a hospital if the flu happens, and in red, the likelihood to die if there is flu, but there is no flu, the likelihood to suffer from flu will prevail among young people. This is a subtlety that we understand as epidemiologists, but it is difficult to for the rest of the people to understand it. This age group, and this is a very wide category from 15 to 64 years of age, represented in this red curve, this is the one with the highest mortality burden, specific cause with this wide group of flu and pneumonia in the first portion of the pneumonia. We have not resolved other important peaks, but we expect similar performance. The message of this disease is important or not? Well, we also face a contradiction because the media at a specific point in time insisted and they said that the Ministry of Health is exaggerating and this is a disease that hasn't contributed to the cases of death. There are other external causes, accidents and diabetes, and this is true if we consider the total population. But you can see this comparison if we see all the age groups and if we compare the end of this table, the deaths of the year 2009 versus 2008 and the average in the last 10 years, there was a mild increase, 1.6% or 20% if we compare it to the average. But if we compare only the intermediate age groups, there was a 40% increase and almost 90% in terms of mortality specific to this cause of death in this age group. So a disease that could cause a little, only a few cases of death, but will affect an extraordinarily important age group for the society. This theoretical comparison that has been presented by the World Health Organization in the Asian region on the different events of respiratory pandemic and events and diseases H5N1 with only a few cases, SARS and the different flu pandemic of the 20th century, we see H1N1, which is represented in the lower right corner, will have a transmission rate that is relatively high compared to the 1918's pandemic and seasonal flu, but low numbers compared to other flus. So we can think that mitigation and prevention intervention and control interventions are more efficiently oriented if we work with groups at higher risk to face severe cases and cases of death, and this is what we did. Now let's see Mexico's preparation and response. Mexico was enrolled in the International Sanitary Code, the version of the year 2005, and Mexico's Senate ratified this in June 2007. We've grown in our involvement in this international code. And before the pandemic, Mexico was notifying one event every 10 days, one public health internationally important event every 10 days. Another important collaboration fora allow us to be given support from by the different countries, by the 7 most industrialized countries. We were also working with North American collaborators, tri-national and individual plans, and this plan, because we were ready and we were following the guidelines of what we were to expect in case of a pandemic. In Mexico, we have our national plan consistent to this regional plan that comprises these elements: risk communication and health promotion, coordination, lab epidemiological surveillance, health service provision, to have a strategic reserve of drugs and inputs and research and development. Now let's see how this preparation worked. We had a national committee of health and we had a financing mechanism in the fund of prevention of catastrophes. This was very important. We constituted a strategic reserve, more than 1.2 million antivirals, dosages of Certamivir and other inputs that were also very useful. We also made coordination materials, technical guides, and social communication materials. Some of the challenges that we saw during the flu were that not all the things that were described in the plan worked efficiently, because we had to learn from our mistakes. We had important challenges in terms of control lines and command lines in the country to give institutional responsibilities, to know the communications channels for the society internally in the different sectors of government, and to achieve co-responsibility of the different multiple relevant players for epidemiological relevance. And I need to be very critical to this epidemiological national system, surveillance system. We have inherited a theoretical and operational paradigm that comes from the 40s. When we count cases, passive statistics, we have description more than analysis, interpretation, prediction, and the formulation of public policy recommendations. A system with these characteristics observes its characteristics. We saw this when we were facing the challenge of responding to a global health challenge. We also have false expectations on epidemiological information. We thought that the number of cases was to save us. And until now, the media and the society still expect how many cases of death, the numbers that we have directly counted doesn't even reach 1,200 cases of death, and this is a very important underestimate of the total impact of this epidemic. I will skip this slide. And what I would like to tell you is that our system is currently evolving, and it should become an epidemiological intelligence system, not only a passive surveillance system. We want to include methodologies that the world has learned in the last 10 or 12 years, like this surveillance based on events and syndromatic surveillance, where there are no predefined surveillance objects. It is a receptive system. It receives different signals, and then it makes a differential diagnosis with all the analysis it makes. Three important pieces of information. Vaccination, we had an important experience in Mexico. Mexico contributed to the global well-being with the identification and by sharing and by donating the strains that we isolated in Mexico so that it could be used for the production of vaccination. However, reciprocity didn't take place, and industrialized countries that were in charge of the world vaccine market, they determined the prices, moments to buy vaccinations despite of the contracts. And at the end, we were given the vaccinations we were supposed to be given since the beginning. This is a comparison. You can see Mexico, one of those countries in this group, the one about the lowest number of vaccines, and other countries, there were many other countries that were not even able to give this vaccination. They were not able to buy it. Externalities, discrimination of our Mexican citizens, the stigma, the assumption that close ports and airports could lead to this, and there was an important economic detriment in sectors like trade and tourism, etc., etc. And just for you to see, these curves represent the number of travelers in international Mexican airports, 2008 in black, and then 2009, April the 23rd, when we found the virus in Mexico. You can see the quick drop, not because of the Mexican policies, but because of the provisions of different countries to give alerts to Mexico, to their passengers, of not going to Mexico. I will stop here because I run out of time, and I only would like to draw one conclusion. These are the images of the top of social responses, including the coin, the social response to the different interventions. It is a shame not to be able to have time to share this with you, but to conclude, it was a mild disease. Virulence is similar to seasonal epidemics, but it can also be very severe and lethal in under subgroups with highest risk or those who face delays in their treatments, and it is impossible to eliminate and to stop this flu, and this flu is going to be one more element in our repertoire of flus and the lessons in terms of preparation and response. There are some other challenges. In terms of epidemiological surveillance, there is a need to make this system a modern one and to make it a very competent system for global health challenges. Externalities, we pay the cost of this opening because of the fact that we were sharing the strain. There were restrictions and we had a terrible economic impact. Access to vaccinations, we are away from risk communications, we're still away from equality, and we need to have timely information. Thank you very much.
Michael D. McDonald.
He is a doctor of public health
with a specialization in health policy and administration from the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. McDonald is president of Global Health Initiative Incorporated, chairman of the board of Wyndham Health Enterprises, past chairman of the EEEE Medical Technology Policy Committee for the United States, past director of health and telecommunication for the Coop Foundation Incorporated. He also was past chairman of the communication and computer application.
Can you please share your presentation?
Yes, I am.
You are sharing?
Pardon me? Okay, let me finish. And member of several corporate boards. Dr. McDonald has been engaged in the design and execution of several health software and health information system projects over the past 15 years. In 1986, he designed and implemented one of the first interactive media distribution of personal health information into the home and the workplace via ISDN and video text. Dr. McDonald is ready.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
In the back.
There.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Okay. So it's great to be with you today from Washington, D.C. I wish I could be there in person with you in Mexico. I'm going to be talking about the perspective of the pandemic from race to resilience. So in the United States, we initiated a pandemic information sharing initiative. And one of the main questions that I'd like to pose is, will the world become more or less resilient under the H1N1 second wave conditions? I'll be talking about from the Global Resilience Network perspective, the public health impact, public health's impact on the H1N1 pandemic and beyond. I'll be focusing on the preparations, the response strategies, for the Southern Hemisphere during the April to August 2010 period. And I'll be talking a bit about the infrastructures that are necessary for preventing and managing disruptions in large-scale crises as they would be tested through the H1N1 second wave in the Southern Hemisphere. In terms of the global resilience system, I'm going to be talking about two aspects in particular, the information sharing environment element and the resilience network elements that affect the management of H1N1 in communities. Now, beyond the H1N1 pandemic, I'd like to lay a framework of levels of risk. In the first level of risk, we have simple, frequently occurring, physically based events like the kinds of fires we would see in buildings. Those kinds of problems are not a problem in the United States or in most countries within Latin America and the Caribbean. We have infrastructures to deal with those levels of threats. The second level are still simple problems, frequently occurring, limited in scale, but biological or economic or social in nature. So small-scale medical and public health events, like, for example, a train crash, would come under that stage two level. In stage three, we have complex, naturally occurring events that a large-scale tsunami or a pandemic would be examples of. A fourth level would be complex, intentionally induced, human-induced events like a WMD or terrorism event. The fifth level of crisis would be complex systems crashes, multinational food crises, for example, climate change, peak oil, water crises, or for a single nation like Haiti, for example, where they've had multiple systems crashes following the earthquake. The perfect storm of a 1918-like virulence pandemic hitting us now would be an example of a stage five crisis. And we were quite concerned about the possibility of that given H5N1. However, we are not concerned about a level five crisis in terms of what we'll see with H1N1 in the Southern Hemisphere this, in the April to August time frame. We may be seeing a level three crisis in the Southern Hemisphere, and that is probably the most likely scenario at this point. Now, in terms of a pandemic, we have not only the biological effects on individual humans, but we have psychological and social effects that lead also to political effects and economic effects. So the virus genetically affects our biology, but a pandemic also, the meme of a pandemic, a self-replicating fragment of culture in regards to the fear of the pandemic's impact on us individually and collectively creates another layering of concern. So as we go forward into the next few months in Latin America and the Southern Hemisphere, what we're able to do is to anticipate to some degree what we might expect. The H1N1 second wave in the Southern Hemisphere is in fact the next anticipatable crisis that we are quite concerned with globally at this point. We also are concerned about other kinds of problems in 2010, like the Sudan election is also an anticipatable social event that we've got to concern ourselves with. But in terms of H1N1 in the Southern Hemisphere, we could see 500 million people be infected by H1N1. At least that is the susceptible population, potentially. If we're thinking about less than 30% of the population in the Southern Hemisphere being infected in the first wave, and if we did not engage multimodal herd immunity in this second wave. We're expecting that cases will increase exponentially in the weeks ahead, and leading up to peak in most cases in the June or July timeframe in Latin America. Most likely the second wave will peak before mid part of July. The peak in the United States happened before we had vaccine-induced herd immunity. But in the case of Latin America and the Caribbean, we have vaccine that will be available. It will not reach probably all of the populations of all of Latin America and the Caribbean, but it can reach the high-risk populations, or a large portion of the high-risk populations. In terms of deaths, we just really do not know yet. But we do know that the young and indigenous populations are likely to get hit the hardest. We know that there will be, in some cases, some economic and sociopolitical effects if we handle H1N1 similarly to what we saw in the second wave in the Northern Hemisphere. But we have the chance to learn from those mistakes and to alter our path in the weeks and months ahead. So what can we expect from H1N1 in the Southern Hemisphere? Probably the attack rate, or let's say the attack rate could be between 20% and 40%. And so we could see a couple hundred million people potentially being infected throughout the Southern Hemisphere. The doubling time as we come up toward the peak will be every 4.5 days. So we'll see a very steep peak, most likely, in this second wave, if it's similar, again, to the second wave we saw in the Northern Hemisphere and the first wave in the Southern Hemisphere. What we don't know is what portions of the population were infected in the first wave in the Southern Hemisphere. So that may actually diminish significantly how H1N1 moves through the Southern Hemisphere. The death rate in Latin America, would it be higher, for example, than the per capita death rate in the United States? You just don't know yet. But there's an argument that it might be, because we have perhaps more indigenous populations that might be infected, and in general, the populations of countries in Latin America are younger, then we may see a larger impact. And if so, we can perhaps expect psychosocial impacts and socioecological impacts. There could be negative impacts on essential and critical infrastructures in terms of overwhelming the medical care system. In the United States, we came pretty close to having some overwhelming effects, and we saw this in other countries as well in the Northern Hemisphere. In terms of negative economic impacts, we saw this with Mexico for example, an economic impact. Mexico did a fabulous job managing its efforts in the second wave. But the first wave, it did have significant economic impacts, as well as other countries in Latin America and the Southern Hemisphere. And in some cases, we saw social and political discontinuities. Ukraine would be an example. So what should be engaged? Clearly, we need viable national and local vaccination programs. In the Northern Hemisphere, second wave, we would wish that we had done better with tying the state and local programs to national programs. There's a chance for this to be done better in Latin America in the second wave. The health systems need to be ready for overwhelming surge, especially in serving younger patients. We don't know if that's going to be the case, but certainly the planning efforts should address that. In terms of antiviral distribution, the antiviral medications still are viable, and that's a decision that has to be made at a national level, whether antivirals will be used and how they would be distributed. In terms of community resilience activities, we would hope that in Latin America, the second wave efforts could improve community resilience significantly. We think that attention should be put on super transmitter populations, meaning children in schools, as they begin to interact with the upsweep of winter in the Southern Hemisphere. These super transmitter populations are very important in regards to the transmission of the virus. However, it might be in the second wave within the Southern Hemisphere, the super transmitters had a large number of them may have already been infected in the first wave. If that's the case and there is immunity within those populations, then we may have a different phenomenon. In terms of high-risk and vulnerable populations, clearly that has to be the central target for any H1N1 interventions because herd immunity is very unlikely to be achieved even with available vaccine. Certainly, we have the option, the opportunity to do better in Latin America than we did in the United States. Because the vaccine is now available. But risk communication is going to be very important. We need to have that risk communication be severity indexed. We need to have the communication take into consideration the severity not only in terms of the virulence of the virus, and in this case, H1N1, we know for most of the population is not going to be very virulent. However, for younger populations and for pregnant women and others with comorbidities, especially chronic pulmonary disease, for example, we know that for them, those populations, we have to tailor the risk communication to be taken into consideration that severity. The communication should also be trigger point based. It's not enough to just give general information about H1N1. We've got to look at the evolution of the second wave and the communication just as populations are beginning to get sick with H1N1. As they are in Chile now, there's an increase in cases. That communication is very different than what we're asking people to do as we come into the peak period, and it's quite different after the peak, especially as the cases have dropped significantly. So the communication should be trigger point based, and it should be prospective. meaning that we should think ahead as to how to engage our interventions. And it should be best practice oriented. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is to establish a multimodal herd immunity. In terms of multimodal herd immunity, what we're trying to do is take the top off of the second wave. So as we go through this wave, by engaging interventions early, like vaccination, personal hygiene, hand washing, management of surface sanitation and fomite control, selective social distancing, self-sequestering, isolation and masks for the sick, self-assessment, triage and self-care, and health system strengthening with good surveillance and situational awareness. These factors would make a very big difference in taking the top off of the second wave in the Southern Hemisphere. Desired outcome is clear. We want to reduce infections, especially the high-risk populations and super transmitters. We want to create temporary behavioral and social immunity, especially when vaccines are not available, and we want to reduce premature deaths. Along with that, we want to reduce unnecessary economic impacts, protect against social disruptions, prevent discontinuities in essential infrastructure, and over the longer term, we want to use our engagements in management of H1N1 as an example of testing how we're enabling more general resilience within our societies and laying the foundation for enduring capacity for public health. Now, this schematic shows how we were looking at the second wave in the United States. So we saw the first cases of 2009 H1N1 in the springtime, early spring in the April time frame, with cases increasing in May. But the dosage of vaccine, we were hoping to have by the September time frame, before the second wave peak. That actually didn't work out that way. We actually had less than 2% of the American population vaccinated before the second wave peak. So the projection of having 50% of Americans immunized was, we were nowhere near that. We were nowhere near herd immunity. The opportunity is better of having broader immunization in the Southern Hemisphere. But again, it's very important to target the high-risk populations first, because it's unlikely probably to achieve herd immunity. Now, in addition to the vaccine, what we need to do is to engage the non-pharmaceutical interventions that I was talking about. In the U.S., we put very significant resources into immunization relative to the non-pharmaceutical intervention. And it could be argued that actually, if you compare our results in terms of cases and deaths, that we would have done better to put more resources into the non-pharmaceutical interventions, especially given the late arrival of the vaccine. And by doing so, we have the opportunity not only to reduce the number of infections and deaths, but also to reduce the impact on the U.S. economy. So ideally, this top grayed area shows what the peak would be like with no intervention, if the society took no actions. But the next peak shows if we only have governmental interactions. The next line shows if we only had private sector interactions, which in the United States managed about 80% of about 80% of our assets were in the private sector. But we see an even greater impact if we have both government and private sector collaboration. So Race to Resilience goals for the 2010 H1N1 second wave in the Southern Hemisphere is to engage an order of magnitude improvement in preparedness, response, and resilience, reduce the risk in the Southern Hemisphere of being exposed to the H1N1 virus, but also to reduce the burden of illness and clinical complications, and ultimately to reduce premature death. We want to reduce unnecessary economic impacts and protect against social discontinuities and manage the public's trust in government. We want to build enduring community-wide collaborative capacities. Overall death rates, let's talk about the assumptions of what's feasible. Overall death rates may be no more than an average flu year, but almost certainly more children and young adults will die than an average year. Countries with a lot of indigenous populations should be particularly concerned about those populations. Because in the Northern Hemisphere and in Australia, we've seen in some cases, in some areas, 3 to 5 times the death rate in severe cases amongst indigenous populations. The H1N1 virus is stable, but that could change. Influenza is highly unpredictable, and given the current understanding. So I'm just going to close with a concept of what we're facing really is a plandemic rather than a pandemic in 2010. It's an opportunity to make a significant impact, not only in terms of the reduction of infections and premature deaths, but also to make an enduring impact on the capacity of our society's ability to deliver public health effectively. To do that, we've got to plan and aggressively implement our H1N1 initiatives, engage vaccine programs targeting the high-risk populations first, and targeting the super transmitter populations early, especially those that have not had immunity from the first wave in the Southern Hemisphere. We need to engage non-pharmaceutical interventions, cognizant of economic, social, and political costs. We need to assess and build multimodal immunity as if there was limited vaccine, even if the vaccine is available, because it's unlikely that the vaccine will get to everyone at risk that needs the H1N1 vaccine. We need to also study the success of our multimodal immunity programs, efforts to create multimodal immunity as a marker for how we create resilience within our societies. So I'm just going to close on that.
Thank you, Dr. McDonald. En aras de tener más información, los ponentes extendieron un poco más.
Our speakers took longer in their presentations, and we have no time for questions. However, speakers are going to stay with us during lunch, and you can ask questions directly, and we have information about Dr. McDonald's, and we can be in touch with them.